I'm very pleased to be introducing today's keynote speaker, Jonathan Goldstein. Jonathan is the author of such fine novels as Lenny Bruce is Dead and Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bible. He's also the creator of a radio show that I think is easily one of the most creative and imaginative programs on the CBC, a show called Wiretap. And before that, and I guess still to this day, he contributes to a show that is easily one of the most creative and imaginative shows on National Public Radio, a show called This American Life. And he's brought in clips from both of those shows, and we're going to listen to them and talk about his unique approach to radio. So do you want to start with the first clip?
Sure. God, I feel like I'm going through puberty. I woke up and my voice was all messed up. I don't know why. I brought this first clip of tape because it was one of the first pieces that I did on This American Life. I worked there as a producer for a couple of years, and the first year that I was there was exclusively producing other writers and other reporters. And during that time, I came out with my first novel, and Ira Glass, the host of the show, liked it, and he was very encouraging of my doing pieces for the radio show, which was really great for me. And so this piece, in retrospect, I realize now is probably kind of the blueprint for what I'm doing now, the show that I'm doing now, Wiretap. And maybe I could talk a bit about that after listening to it. But I'll just say this, that I was dying to get my friend Josh, who's in this next clip of tape, onto This American Life. But the way that a show like This American Life works with the story meetings, very story obsessed. So you can't just walk into a story meeting and say, I think my friend Josh is really funny. It would be really cool if we could put him on the show. There needed to be some kind of, not only a story, but really a very tightly structured story with a beginning and a middle and an end that you could, you know, coherently pitch. And so So we came up with this, and so this is the beginning, and it's actually Josh sort of pitching me the story. It becomes a story about a story. The story becomes a kind of character, and you sort of root for the story as it goes. So this is Josh pitching me on this story.
And I think that's
and it is a piece of this. Yeah.
Sorry, I was just going to tell them that's number one on the CD that Jonathan brought, if we can fire that.
I mean, I can imagine you really liking this message.
Oh, I see.
But you see, I can't imagine it being the kind of thing that, you know, was
that
like...
That your sedate NPR audience would appreciate?
No. I mean, I mean, it sounds like you got a kick out of it at the time. But I mean, you know, I mean, I can't imagine it being like an atomic bomb that hit the campus or something.
Yeah. See, this is clearly another example of the failure of your imagination. How many times have I given you ideas that you have naysayed? How many times have I given you gold standard ideas?
Josh yells at me a lot, especially when he thinks I'm not taking his ideas seriously. When we go out to eat, he yells at me loud enough to make the other patrons turn around and look at us. Sometimes, though, he'll get all unexpectedly silent and just stare out the restaurant window, and then turn to me and say something like, "Wouldn't life be better if there was a big old pig sitting out there by the fire hydrant? Why can't life be more like that?"
I went to Columbia University in the early 90s, okay? Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
When I was there, they had this phone system. I'll just give you a little bit of background, all right? And then I'll cut to the chase. They had this system there called the Rome system. Phone system, R-O-L-M. And you could forward messages to people, okay? You could forward messages to everyone on campus if you wanted, okay?
Sort of like a precursor to the internet.
Yes, like a precursor to the internet. Thank you, Mr. Current Affairs guy. All right, so it was an amazing utility. People could forward all kinds of crazy messages.
Yeah,
and so one day there was this guy named Fred. Okay, and he got this message. Well, his mother left him a message on his answering machine. Okay, and he forwarded it to, I don't know, maybe one or more of his friends, and they forwarded this message across campus to everyone. Okay. So, you want to hear the message?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, he prefaced it by saying...
Wait, you have it? You have the message?
I do not have the message. I have the message in my head. I'm telling you a story. So, the message... He prefaced it by some kind of sad little lead-in. In a little voice, he was like, I think you'd appreciate hearing this message from my mother. Okay? And then the message... This was the entirety of the message. And I'm going to do the voice for you as best I can. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, sorry. More background. He apparently had a hard. He was not a hit with the ladies, Fred. Okay, this is what I was led to understand. Okay, yeah. I'm not sure if this is true or not.
Okay,
but he had managed to score a date to go see The Little Mermaid of all movies. Okay, The Little Mermaid. Okay,
yeah.
So this is the message his own mother, okay, his blood relation, leaves for him.
Yeah,
and I quote: "Ahem. You and the Little Mermaid can both go." Yourselves. The books you wanted, they're not here. They must be in La Jolla. I'm not going to wait up all night for you. Goodbye. That's the entirety of it, all right?
Yeah. That's a message that his mother left him.
That's correct. You catch that part? Yeah. You and the Little Mermaid can both go f*** yourselves. I love you, son. Okay? That's gold.
Hold on.
Yeah. Then... Are you going to listen?
Yes.
All right. Then somebody took it. I don't know. Some evil mixmeister genius took it and remixed it into a 12-inch dance version. All right. You know, you and the Little Mermaid, La Jolla, La Jolla. F*** yourself. They're not here. The book. Goodbye.
And there's other people who remember it.
Are you even listening to a word I just told you? This was the producers of its day, okay? It was everyone heard about it, everyone knew it, everyone had an opinion about it. Every single person who attended Columbia that year would, I guarantee you, they would know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so that was the beginning.
And so you did end up tracking down the original message, right?
Amazingly, yeah. Like, I mean, in terms of just reporting and story gathering, like, there was a confluence of great fortuitous kind of things happening. When I called up the registrar's office, the guy that I, at Columbia, like, when I just mentioned, I was like, you aren't going to remember this, but there was this message, Little Mermaid, he remembered it, he quoted it back to me verbatim, he gave me Fred... The kid that received the message from his mother, he gave me that guy's contact information. I mean, it all came together, and there was a lot of beats to it. I think the message ended up becoming the basis for the end of year musical that Columbia puts on, this tradition that dates back to Rodgers and Hammerstein. So it was like completely huge.
And I'm curious about the inclusion of Josh in the story at the very beginning, because, you know, the standard way of looking at something like that, you wouldn't have that conversation at the beginning of the story, right?
Yeah.
And what, like, and you guys have a certain back and forth between each other. How does that sort of add to or affect our perception of the rest of the story?
Well, I think, like, it is the story. The story to me was what do you call that thing? The thing that moves along a plot, this MacGuffin, yeah. What I was most interested in was the dynamic, the way that me and Josh would talk and how funny I found them. I felt like to know that this story that sounds ridiculous is coming from this guy is what gives it its personality and its character. And that was important for me to include. And I feel like it that deepened the story. And because I'm not a reporter, I felt like I was able to kind of do something, I guess, more literary as defined by, you know, talking behind someone's back. Like, as Josh is talking, it's rude. I mean, like, I fade him down and I'm talking about him behind his back, which you can't do as a reporter. And I'll say this too, that, I mean, when I started working at This American Life, I signed on because I like the funny stuff. I mean, I like the serious newsy stuff too, but I think I was most attracted to the stories by David Sedaris and Sarah Vowell and, you know, that kind of thing. And when I started working there, September 11th happened pretty shortly afterwards, and then the show changed for a while. I mean, I was working on, like, a story comparatively frivolous. I mean, it was the comedian Jonathan Katz was I had tons of tape of him and his sister riding in the back of a limousine, retracing their old childhood homes in Brooklyn. And that's what I was working on at the time of September 11th. And then the show changed and it became something, like, I didn't have any experience in report. For me, it was like journalism camp. But I think like what I was most interested in was like a kind of, I don't know, like a less reporty kind of more talk behind the backy literary kind of radio, I guess.
Well, yeah, and that's interesting. You mentioned sort of the literary aspect of what you do, and I think this piece is a good example of it, where you take a real thing and then build fiction around it, right? I mean, that conversation between you and Josh, that was a scripted conversation, right?
It wasn't a scripted conversation, but it's funny, actually, because at the time, I remember I told Ira about Josh's telling me about this story, and he said, go into the studio and have a conversation about it. And I was thinking, but then won't that be strange? Like, what are they going to think that I walk around all the time? Like, because the way I think I introduce it is like, just the other day I was talking to my friend Josh as though everything that I do is recorded. And Ira was completely, he didn't see a problem in it at all. And he was like, no, you don't understand. People listen to the show and they think like we're these little people who live inside the radio and everything that we do is somehow mic'd and it doesn't matter. It's going to be fine. And it was.
That's actually a pretty good Ira Glass impression.
And I know my voice isn't what it should be.
So why don't we move on to the next clip? And that was another one from This American Life, right? What I Should Have Said?
Yeah, and it's a similar kind of thing where there's an interaction between talk and tape, and there's more, you know, talking behind the person's back and that kind of thing. I'll set it up by just saying that I think the premise of this piece was that how I regret every single thing that I do and say, even as I'm saying it. And I thought that a remedy for this might be to record my day's doings and then be able to, this was a very stupid idea, obviously, but to listen to it all afterwards as a form of therapy or something, I don't know. And then, you know, go through it and figure out how I could have done better and then become a better person. Stupid.
And that one is track two up there, Darren.
I give you the ring of power, okay? What are you going to do?
Oh, sorry, can you just pause it for a second?
What are you going to do with it?
Sorry, I should say, actually, this conversation takes place with a guy named Billy who hangs out in this used bookstore all the time whenever I get into it. And I have no idea how this came about, but we somehow got into a conversation of all things about Lord of the Rings, which he's an expert on, evidently. And so this is the conversation that we're getting into about the ring of power. Sorry.
I give you the ring of power, okay? What are you going to do with it, John? What are you going to do with it? No question about it. You wouldn't pull it off. You couldn't pull it off. You'd die. Your soul would be taken. Finished. End of story. You wouldn't cut it. You wouldn't cut it on the throne. You wouldn't even be a steward of Gondor. You wouldn't even be one of the Rohirrim, you know? And you want to hold the ring. You can hold the ring, John.
Now, if I could have just paused things right here, right at this very moment, paced around a bit, shadowboxed myself towards the right state of mind, I might have found the gumption to say that I didn't even want the stinking ring, because all it does is turn you into a pretentious diva anyway. Everyone who holds it becomes Zsa Zsa Gabor. I would have said that even thinking about this ring stuff was for 14-year-old black-hooded goth kids who strap suede pouches of 20-sided dice from their belts as fashion accessories. Instead, I answered this way.
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
To which Billy replied,
"You don't know. You don't. There's even a question? No, Jonathan, you couldn't hold the one ring of power. I wouldn't trust you for a second with the ring of power. Not for a second."
Then I started to backpedal, saying that he was probably right, that I was ill-equipped to hold the ring. I was weak-willed and had little sense of community. I then said that he, Billy, was probably better suited to the task of ring-bearer, to which Billy responded,
"I wouldn't touch the ring, John, okay? Gandalf wouldn't touch the ring. Elrond wouldn't touch the ring. Fools like Boromir tried to touch the ring, but they died. Okay? I cannot handle the ring. I'm not of hobbit stock. I don't have that kind of hardiness."
Okay, stop right here. No, Billy, you don't have that kind of hardiness. You wear yellow sweatpants, and your hands are as smooth as peeled tangerines. You possess the unearthly habit of pulling jawbreakers out of your mouth every 5 seconds to check what color they are. And whenever you burp, you're compelled to simultaneously speak the word Ralph. But if you're standing there with Billy, looking into his eyes, frozen or not, of course you don't say anything so mean, despite the fact that you want to. We all carry the ring around inside of us, and that ring is our capacity for wrongdoing. And both he and I, in some way, wish that this capacity could be removed from within us and pounded out into a shiny ring that could be passed around from person to person, allowing us to ease the burden of our urges. Such urges, say, as wanting to voice the really mean things we really think, but in the end, that would be appalling. And rather than voicing any of this, I said instead,
I don't know.
I think the irony is that I'm saying how appalling it would be to voice those things, and here I am instead playing it for a room full of people.
Yeah, and I think what I like about that is I've never read The Lord of the Rings or watched any of the movies, and I don't know any of the references you're making, but I still was able to get the joke. Is there a method to how you reference something like that might be a little bit obscure, but still bring it back to something everybody can relate to?
I don't know. I hope it is. I mean, I remember at the time in the editing process, because there was a whole bunch of different scenes that were taken from that day and some that were not included in the piece. And this one, I remember there was some back and forth with the producers at This American Life about whether it was funny, obscure, or whether it was just obscure. And I think it's probably an editorial decision. I was arguing in favor of that it was funny, and people probably now even more so understand, like, they have a kind of shorthand for nerd culture, you know, and there's certain, you know, like the 20-sided dice, I think, is kind of like an icon or, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what makes everybody get that reference is that you connect it with that emotion that everybody has felt of having to suppress the mean things in your head that you want to say.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think that's, that isn't exclusively what literature is, but, it is about, I guess, the real world and what's going on in your head at the same time. And, I actually just the other day finished reading, I was reading those John Updike, the Rabbit books, you know, the 4 books, I think. And in the third book, it's about this character, Rabbit Angstrom, and he's kind of a prick. And it's always inside his head, you know. It's not told in the first person, but it's always his perspective. And finally, like in the final pages of the third book, where you're following this character all the way since he's in his early 20s, and now he's in his late 40s, and there's a character who appears who admits that she, a minor character, a friend of the wife, who admits that she loves him. And he is curious about why. And so he kind of is like shyly asks her, and she goes off on this tangent where you're experiencing this guy, Rabbit Angstrom, in a way that you have not been for the past like thousands of pages, where you're in his head and you're kind of... you know, you're kind of, it feels like it's haunted, like there's the Phantom of the Opera. But then all of a sudden that world is punctured with like the outside world, you know, of this person who goes on about how she loves the way that he enters a room and his shy smile and the way that he sits. And I don't know. And all of a sudden in that moment, you just realize like the discord between the way that someone could see themselves and the way that they're seen by the outside world. And usually it's the other way around, where it's kind of revelatory. You get to know a person more from what they're thinking than what they're actually saying in the real world. But I don't know, I that kind of interplay, I think, between what you call actuality tape and script can, you know, that normally the DNA of reported stories could be really put to interesting use also, you know.
And another thing I noticed with this piece is it's kind of the emergence of I don't want to say the character you play on Wiretap, but it, you know, you have that sort of sad sack, yeah, kind of schmucky guy, and you know, that's not the typical position for the host or the documentary producer to be in, right? They're the voice of authority, and you're saying, well, I don't know. You're,
yeah, kinda... yeah, yeah, I know, yeah, I know, I don't know. Like, I guess I don't know if it comes from a happy place. Maybe it's just sort of like, you know, you disarm yourself before someone else can, you know, Or, but on the positive side, I guess it's also sort of like you're creating an intimacy out of that. You're kind of a stand-in for, well, I mean, you allow your audience to feel like they're superior to you in every single way, which I think an audience would enjoy to some extent. But also, I think it creates, yeah, I think it can create, in its better moments, a kind of intimacy where you're saying, "Look, I don't know anything. I'm not a voice of authority." And I think sometimes even when you're reporting a story, not funny stories, that could be kind of a good starting point, you know, to say we're kind of in this together. And I'm no expert. And I think if you guys have been following those stories on This American Life and Planet Money, it's kind of their technique where they kind of admit for you, like, we don't understand, the financial crisis, and we're gonna create a primer for you here.
Okay, well, why don't we get on to the next clip? And this was very early on in Wiretap, right? The lobby?
Right, okay, yeah. And I'll say more about it afterwards. But actually, this, I think, was really... This was the piece that I did for the show's pilot. And it was... I think it was really kind of that nexus from the world of This American Life into what I ended up doing on Wiretap. And I'll just set it up by saying this. It's a friend of mine who's telling a story about... Well, it starts where he is... he's just bought a new VCR, and he's programming the channels. And you know how it goes all the way up the band looking for channels that aren't static. And he hits this channel at like 74 or something, which is the short-circuit surveillance camera image of a lobby, like an apartment building lobby. But he doesn't live in an apartment building, so he doesn't know where this video of the lobby is coming from. And he becomes curious about it. And he starts wandering, you know, he has a dog, he walks the dog around the neighborhood looking for this lobby. And slowly he becomes really quite obsessed with it. He starts watching this lobby channel. Like, let's say there's nothing good on TV and it's a choice between either golf or the lobby channel. He'll watch the lobby channel. And he's kind of doing this Encyclopedia Brown kind of thing, trying to see, you know, cars going by in the window or people walking by to try to figure out where it is. And it progresses to the point where he begins throwing a videotape into the machine to video what's going on in the lobby, so he could fast forward when he's not at home, or, you know, that kind of thing. So and then what happens is he ends up seeing a woman one day, and he starts watching this woman and starts to get to know her comings and goings. And I think at this point, before the clip I'm about to play, he sees that she's kind of got a boyfriend. And he starts making judgments about their relationship just based on what he is seeing from the silent surveillance video. So here's the part. This is to the end of the story. This is the end of the story.
You know, once I remember them coming in together, and as usual, she dropped her keys or something, fumbled over her hand. She bent down to get him, and I thought, how come he's not bending down and getting him for her? I thought, what kind of relationship is this? You know, one night, after I watched the two of them come into the lobby, I thought, well, what's going to happen? I wonder if this guy's really going to stay around for a long time. So I kept the tape running just in case I missed something. But I went into the kitchen and made dinner and sat down in front of the TV and watched it.
You watch while eating dinner?
I watched the TV, mm-hmm. The lobby, and I was wondering, you know, if I would see this guy leave. And he didn't leave.
And how late did you end up watching until?
I watched it till around midnight.
And he didn't leave?
No. So I watched it for about 6 hours. Put in another VHS tape, and I put it at SLP, long speed.
Mm-hmm.
He never left.
He didn't. He never came out?
No. Hours and hours of tape, and I just sort of fast forward through it, but no, he never left. And I thought, good for her.
And that's it? Just good for her?
Yeah.
Nothing else?
No.
Not a little something else?
No, I was like now growing, I was becoming concerned for her happiness. But it's over. Whatever it is, it's over. And so I thought, okay, as a grand finale, I went over and I actually deleted that channel to the lobby channel.
So it's not. So now when you go from, say, PBS to Fox, it just goes straight.
Yeah, straight through.
Straight through. No,
no more lobby.
Lobby. Nothing.
Yeah, no.
It's gone.
It's over.
Hmm.
Yeah. I wasn't disappointed. But it was just like, I don't know. It sort of signified the end of winter. And spring was coming and it was time to move on.
So I'll say this, that what I had, like I had to put together this pilot and I didn't have a lot to go by. And I didn't even know what kind of show it was going to be, Wiretap. I had no form for it. And the form that it took was basically, I guess, directly proportional to my own limitations in terms of what I was capable of, where my talents lied, and what I could afford. Like at This American Life, they have a budget that allows them to kill half the stories that actually even go into production that are kind of far along. But in my case, I had this friend who told me about this image that he started to see on his VCR, you know, a rather honest TV of this lobby. And it felt like the first act of something very interesting and like one of these kind of like 1970s paranoia films or Hitchcock or something. The problem was that nothing happened. That was the truth. And as he was telling the story, I quickly realized that, but I had to basically turn it into a story. And so that's when fiction came into the picture. Initially, it wasn't like I had some kind of philosophical mandate or I felt like I want to blend fiction and nonfiction. I basically just wanted to get a story, a good story on the air. So it has elements, this story of like of a This American Life kind of interview. Even the use of the music is very This American Life. And but what happens is that nothing happened. So this friend of mine, Bert, who's telling the story, is not an actor. But we tried improvising different scenarios for what could happen. And the one that took, the one that seemed to work the best was that he sees this woman and starts to slowly fall in love with her. And that was the ending that you heard. But it went further. We tried all kinds of different things that ended up not working as well, where he runs into her at a party and, you know, develops some kind of relationship. But it seemed to work best as this. So it was born out of necessity, the fiction part. But as an aesthetic thing, it I don't know, I hope it allows for a kind of natural performance style. Like even that moment where he gives that nervous conversational laugh, where he says that he was starting to feel for her, and he kind of self-consciously laughs, and then the music comes in. It was a real laugh. He was laughing, you know, at himself for the performance that he was given, but giving the context, it, you know, in the new context, and the way that, what's cool about radio too and working with non-professional actors is you could really micro edit performances together and take a laugh like that and lift it out of its context and give it a new context and score it in a particular way. And it's, yeah, so that, and so that basically became, that was, I guess, the birth of Wiretap, was that there wasn't the time or the money to be searching around too much for stories, so then I had to start creating them out of what I had.
So although it did sort of come out of necessity, I think it is a somewhat revolutionary idea at the time, because, you know, and still to this day, there's this separation between there's radio theater and there's radio documentary. And, you know, theater's made up and documentaries are real, but, you know, in reality, there's a bit of fact and fiction in both, right? And I think you're sort of maybe being more honest about it?
I don't know. Okay, that's a nice way to put it, but yeah. But certainly when I first started doing the show, people took at face value everything that was on, and because the CBC and radio is kind of a newsy medium, and it was the same thing like with, you know, War of the Worlds. I mean, where like people, you know, take what they hear on the radio at face value to a certain extent. And also another like nice thing that was the, I mean, that kind of works against the whole IRAs, people living in the radio, is on a telephone too, it isn't, it doesn't telegraph its radio drama hood. You know, it's a, it allows for a kind of radio drama that doesn't telegraph itself, you know, with like the clomping horse coconut hoofs and the chips, you know. And it also allows non-actors to feel relaxed a little bit more, like to be talking on a telephone as opposed to leaning into a microphone in their comfort zone in their own homes, I think brought out a more relaxed kind of performance style. And I'll say this too. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Joe Frank, but he was doing, as far as I know, he was like kind of even a big influence on This American Life too, in his use of cinematic music, and he did a blending of fiction and nonfiction too. I'm always curious about how he does the show, and sometimes I'll run into someone who's worked with him or an old intern or whatever. And I a while back I spoke to an intern who told me that the way that he would do it was he would actually, I don't know if this is so, I mean, this is what she told me, that he would actually transcribe actual conversations that he would have and then give it to the intern. Like, it could be very personal things, like breaking up with a girlfriend or something, and she would transcribe it and give it to him on paper, and he would structure it on paper and then get actors that he was friendly with to re-perform it over the telephone for his radio show.
Well, on the note of working with non-professional actors, why don't we play a clip from your father there, who is non-professional. I don't know if you can classify him as non-professional anymore. He's on your show so often.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, I will say that, I mean, he certainly wasn't in the drama club in high school or anything. Are you thinking of this?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, this is, I guess, it's in a similar vein as the lobby thing. I'll explain afterwards. Yeah, so this comes at the end of my father and I having a conversation about, he was stationed in Germany, but he made this trip to Barcelona when he was in his early 20s, and it was the greatest time of his life, and he's never really gone any place, and he'd always talk about this trip, and a couple summers ago, he ended up going back to Barcelona 50 years later, and he was just really excited about it, and he knew, he was like, oh, I'm going to go to this place and that place, and I was like, don't you think maybe 50 years later these places don't exist anymore? And he's like, no, what are you talking about? So this is just the tail end of our conversation where he's kind of expressing a kind of disappointment, a bittersweet disappointment. So that was sort of like, we had a kind of earnest conversation, and then I didn't know how to end it, and I thought maybe it was a little too saccharine and there should be a way to cut the treacle a little bit. So I was like, I don't know, maybe I have mom screaming in the background. And then I was like, I don't know, she got an olive. I don't know how I was like, I don't know, maybe she got like an olive stuck in the bathtub drain. So that was like, that was a combination of fiction and nonfiction, and the olive part was the fiction, and it took a surprisingly long time just to to get that performance. I got this other little clip where from something other where I'm directing my father. It's just like the raw tape, like a 45 seconds or so of just me trying to get my dad to say a couple words and being kind of a fascist about it.
So go ahead, try it a couple different ways. I'll just let you do.
Okay.
I won't even say anything. Just try a couple, like interjection style. You know what I mean? Like, you know something, Johnny? Like where you're taking a breath and you're like, you know something?
You know something, Johnny? I'm thinking back in those days, even then. You know, you were a contrary little son of a SOB. Ugh, I screwed that up.
You know, try it again without the laugh. Just the way you did it before is okay. Deadpan. You know something, Johnny? Okay. Just like that. You know, like really deadpan.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You know something, Johnny? Even in those days, you were a contrary SOB. I'm not to start coming out right.
No, it's good. You know Johnny was good? Just try a few you know something, Johnny's okay. In a row. Okay. You know what I mean? Just try.
Just you know something, Johnny. That's it?
Just the way you said it, just like that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You know something, Johnny? You know something, Johnny? You know something, Johnny? You know something, Johnny?
Yeah, sometimes the hardest, and it feels weird talking, like I almost feel like George the Animal Steel coming out to tell everyone that professional wrestling is fixed, and I don't know that it does anything to enhance anybody's enjoyment of it, but sometimes even getting my mother to pick up the phone and say hello in a natural way is the hardest thing in the world. Like the things that are just invisible to us, that are just an organic part of natural conversationalness, can sometimes be the hardest thing in the world to recreate. Like just to say hello. So sometimes I'll just I'll pretend the phone went dead in the middle of the conversation. So when I call her back, she'll say hello in the proper way, you know, just in a normal way.
And I, you know, your parents and a lot of the characters on the show, I mean, they're exaggerated, and you're kind of scripting it or setting up these interactions between you two, but it, I get the impression they're based somewhat on real life. Like, your parents do yell at each other a fair bit.
Yeah, I mean, if they were like this British couple sitting in the backyard, drinking tea, that would be weird. But yeah, they are that. They are who they are. And the thing that was kind of a revelation and weird was to see how the kind of self-awareness they had about who they are, the kind of the scripts that they carry through life, and the way that they kind of perform their relationship, and how they're able to turn it on to such an extent that it makes you feel as though like your own childhood was some kind of controlled experiment, because they really know, like when they know how to be themselves, or to be themselves but bigger.
And that's a hard thing. When people have a microphone in front of them, it's very hard to shut that off, and they want to, you know, not be themselves and be this controlled, scripted thing, you know, but how do you get them to really be themselves?
Some days are easier than others. A great thing is that they have no memory. Sometimes when we finish recording, they don't even know that, they're like, oh, you were recording that? And I'm like, yeah, why do you think I made you say, you know, you're a contrary SOB like 50 times in a row? That's not a normal conversation. But to them, I guess it is. And yeah, there was one time when we had this conversation and I thought it was great. And it was like just really, I don't know, it was just kind of perfect. And the CD recorder wasn't working. And I felt sick about it, and I called them back like a couple days later to try to recreate it, and they had no memory of the previous conversation that we had, which was kind of both great and eerie. So we were able to just recreate it. It's good. I mean, when you have parents who kind of don't like when they're on the show, they call me up afterwards and they say, we listened to the show, we were great. But for the most part, they're kind of I've sat with them one time when they were listening to the show, and I think my father stubbed his toe, and my mother was running around the house looking for gauze, and he was screaming, and but it's good because it kind of frees you up to kind of do whatever you want to do, and you know that they're not going to care one way or the other. So yeah, there's a kind of I don't know, it's neat when you see some people that just have never been called upon to demonstrate a particular kind of talent, say acting or whatever, and you give them that opportunity and you create a forum for it, and they rise to the occasion.
Well, I think that's a good segue into the haters.
Oh, okay.
Clip, if you want to get to that one.
Yeah, sure.
Johnson, this is Max. You're probably trembling. You're probably shaking in your boots. Jonathan, little teacher's pet. We think we're so smart, don't we? Just because you got a good grade on a stupid math test, you think you're smarter than me? Jonathan, are you there? You must be glad you weren't at home today, because I would come right over, ring your doorbell, and put you right in your big, fat nose. I've never liked you, but now it's over. Now I'm going to beat you so hard that you...
All of my life, I have been hated. As a result, I have more enemies than rap singing sensation 50 Cent. I have so many haters hanging on my Bozak that, quite frankly, there is very little room on my Bozak for anything else. Least of all, the love of a good woman. It is my belief that most people's hatred of me lies in the fact that in their heart of hearts, people despise excellence. And this is not my fault. I have repeated this to myself as a kind of mantra since I was but a young boy. I must confess that as I speak these words, I am curling a 35-pound weight in each of my arms. I enjoy a good workout, and will make time for one every chance I get. 195, 196, 197. Can you detect even a hint of strain? Am I breathless? Does my voice show signs of wearying as I bring each dumbbell up to my pecs? 200, 201. Does my mouth drift from the mic? I assure you that it does not. I am always within the mic's range, and my voice level does not fluctuate. As I speak, I am admiring my shirtless body in the reflection of the mirror. Hey there, you.
What's to say?
Well, first of all, where did you find that kid?
I had a whole bunch of kids. I had a friend who was working at a junior high, and she was a guidance counselor, and she brought the kids into the office. I don't know if the school knew about it, but I appreciated it. And I just basically had these kids lay into me. I'm not sure to what effect. I mean, we're regular, like normally, you know, actuality is, you know, you're talking about something, someone's talking in the real world, a farmer, or, you know, whatever. But in this case, it's something that is meant to be, I guess, more abstract, impressionistic, and psychological, you know, and hopefully, I mean, so the way the show was structured was there were these kids that you know, kind of felt were sort of like from my childhood who were leaving me these messages on my phone, and then you'd hear me as an adult doing this monologue. I don't know what the effect really was, but it was, I guess it was meant to create some kind of psychological landscape or something and be funny, hopefully.
And I think I also noticed that sort of sad sack character coming through again, and you're playing,
which, by the
up,
way, is me.
Like your parents are just like your parents in real life. Yeah. And you know, you very much play up the uncool aspect of it, and the haters on your Bozak. I mean, you really play that side of it up, right?
Yeah, okay.
Another thing I noticed in that, there's a part where the kid trips up right before the interference we heard there, but he kind of trips up, and you left that in.
I liked it, and it kind of felt like, I don't know, it felt like a little Brechtian moment or something where the kid kind of, it almost seemed like something that a kid would do too, like they'd get all carried away and all the things they're going to do to you, and then have this moment where, I don't know, it just felt very real. And so I thought, like having the music fall away during that part was kind of was a neat effect.
And you know, I noticed similar to I compared this piece in my head to a piece you did that we discussed called you Juggling on the Radio, where you play up the fact that you can't see me, so I can tell you I'm curling a 35-pound, weight.
Yeah. The Juggling on the Radio was where I brought someone in who actually knew how to juggle, and we rented one of the CBC big studios, because normally I record in a pretty small little booth. We got the big performance studio, and the guy came in and was juggling. He was going to teach me how to juggle on the radio, which was absurdist. But then I came to the conclusion that you could just fake it and throw in sound effects and big deal. So like, yeah, I guess it always comes, the underlying joke that always keeps coming back with the curling or whatever is that because you can't see anything, it's such a great ripe medium for lying.
As far as lying and sort of blending fact and fiction, I guess I'm curious. I mean, that piece, you were obviously, everybody knew it was a joke. Yeah. It was played up. But there are times on the show when there's sort of that middle ground where you don't know if it is real or fiction. And I'm wondering how you sort of play with that dynamic, and when you reveal something is fiction.
It's difficult because, I mean, like I started to say before, in the beginning, everyone assumed that everything was true. Now I feel like I have the opposite problem. Everyone thinks that things are lies. And
actually, I believe I've heard the show referred to as Liar Tap.
Yes, right. It's, I mean, I feel like we've developed ways of kind of tipping our hand and kind of affecting a different kind of posture when things were real. But sometimes, I mean, I'm surprised that people, like I did a story a while ago about some guy who was impostering me on Twitter, and I called him up on the telephone and confronted him about it. And for a story like that, I mean, I think it would be important to know that it's nonfiction, because I think to lie about something like that would be kind of, I don't know, given the way that it played out, it would be kind of a weird thing to do. And then you end up using a different part of your brain to also relate to fiction, you know? And so I went to pains before telling that story that I know that the show is often not true, but the story is actually true, and, you know, it's really true, you know? But yet still people have come up to me afterwards and said, is that really true? So it's kind of like this Twilight Zone-y kind of like Boy Who Cried Wolf. Like, now nothing I do is considered real. So it's my own fault. And as a result, I think the show's become a lot in recent seasons, a lot more meta. It's become like, meta is like a fancy word for saying it's like the Muppet Show. You know what I mean? It's like about a show within a show, you know? There's the monologues, which are like the part where I kind of like step to the nape of the stage. And then there's the conversations, which are sort of, you know, where, you know, Scooter and Ralph or whatever are searching for Lola Flanna because she's the next guest, you know, to do a duet with Kermit or whatever. I don't know, it's becoming like, I don't know if it's a good thing, but it's definitely becoming more meta, I think, as a result. It's kind of turning in on itself. Like, we did one this season where Howard puts out his own version of the show where he does a director's audio commentary over my voice for the, you know, like a commentary on a radio show. So.
Well, and I think you're right in the way that it affects sort of how people perceive the show. And I know even the way I listen to the show, a good example of this was something from earlier this season where you were interviewing this guy who chased rainbows. And he drove around in a van, he chased rainbows. And I listened to most of that story thinking, well, is this real or not? And I was waiting for that sort of reveal to say, okay, this is a joke. And I think it you know, you're listening really intently for that reveal. And I think that's a big part of how people perceive the show.
Yeah, and I hope it's not distracting, right? That was what was based on the storm chasers. So instead of chasing hurricanes, this guy's chasing rainbows. And I think the reveal came when his mom picked up the phone during the interview and was like, I need my van back. You're going to have to chase your rainbows, you know, by foot with your friends.
And it was perfectly timed because I was just beginning to think, okay, maybe this is real. Like, maybe there is a guy who chases rainbows.
Yeah.
It's not that far-fetched.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's a weird world, so who knows, yeah.
Well, should we get to another clip here?
Sure. It's in a similar vein, I guess, to the Sure. Let's listen to this.
When we met, I mean, the thing that really struck me about you, it was actually your smile.
Oh yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
I'm serious. You have a really, really amazing smile. And like, there's you have a lot of amazing qualities, and I'm sure you're going to find someone else. You will. You will. I don't know what to say. You know, we've had a great time together. We've had a great time, but it's just not, I'm not feeling it. There's a lot of things. At first, things seem great. You love to dance. And it's been very hard for me to find someone who loves dance as much as I do.
Yeah, and I took those hip-hop dance classes at the Y every single Tuesday night after work for you.
I know, but that... Well, you tried, but I mean, this is part of the problem, is you look like you're like some kind of retarded monkey when you do it, frankly. Listen, anyway, I don't like, you're a really, really great guy. It's just sometimes you get a bit, that party we were at a few weeks ago, do you remember? You had like two drinks, and... I'm sitting on a stool. It's a wobbly stool. You come, you insist on sitting on my lap, and you fall off. Do you even remember doing that?
I remember you made me feel fat.
It wasn't because you're fat. It's not because you're fat. You're just drunk.
Drunk and fat.
What, because I said your ass didn't sit on my knee? What does this mean, fat? It means that your ass is like, just doesn't fit on my knee. You know, it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean you're fat. You're so paranoid. Everything I say gets dissected into something that I didn't mean.
I thought that you liked our closeness. You know, that was one of the things that you didn't have in your other relationships.
You're right. And at first it was great. But, you know, I mean, there's closeness, and then there's you actually get in my face. When you talk, you're an extremely close talker. I'm sorry, but you get, like, right in my face.
It's intimacy.
It's not intimacy, it's, I don't know what the hell it is. You know, one time we were at a party, and you were talking to me, you were talking so close to me, so close, that I swear to God, a piece of food left your mouth and entered my mouth. It actually left your mouth and entered mine, and I tasted it. It was like sausage. It was disgusting.
So that was an early show also where the idea was I wanted to have different people break up with me and see what that was like for both of us. And it was structured as there was a series of them throughout the show and with monologue pieces. And the thing, that, again, okay, so this speaks to the whole fiction, nonfiction thing. Although the setup was BS, what ended up ensuing, I feel... was actually quite, the emotions were real. What people told me afterwards was that in one case, one of my friends ended up kind of almost reading from a script that he had given to his last girlfriend when he broke up with her. He found himself slipping into that where he was saying the same things to me that he had said to her. And what was surprising for me was actually how hurtful it felt. You know, even though it was a total construct, there was somebody like, and this guy James, my good friend James, who is a very mild guy, and as I kind of wasn't surprised that he had such a killer instinct and could be so cruel when having to sever ties, even if they were imagined ties with somebody. So yeah, it was it started off as a fiction, but it revealed, I think, something quite real.
I think that is just about all our time here. But if we want to, if anybody wants to ask Jonathan some questions, there's a microphone right there.
You feel like sometimes I save up wiretaps and I listen to them in a row, and I think that I have this desire to abuse you the way
to what?
To abuse you the way your characters. Like, I feel like if I ever to. Like, do you feel like people treat you differently because you set up this character that where people yell at you a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like I feel differently about myself since I turned, you know, the subtleties of my personality into like a Yiddish opera. I'm shocked. Like when I go to, I was doing a book signing thing a little while ago, and like people will say the most, like someone said to me, someone told me that I had a face for radio. Someone else told me that they fall asleep to my voice. And in case I should interpret that in a nice way, they clarified by saying, it's because you have a very boring voice. And so being in public sometimes feels like you're, you know, on one of those chairs at the carnival where they, you know, for a dollar you get four balls and they get to throw it at you and dunk you. And just for showing up, just for existing, you know. So, yeah. And you're not going to abuse me, Roman. Okay.
Hi. I wanted to ask you, well, first of all, to make a comment that the two shows that you've have worked on and are working on are kind of, they define contemporary radio and what's funny on the radio and so forth. But I'm wondering if you have any, say, heroes or models from old radio, any influences from old-time radio, and who are they?
I do, and also contemporary. Like, definitely, I don't know. Are you guys familiar with Joe Frank? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, huge... I mean, there's certain people that you just listen, like it's like with writers, there's certain writers or people that you listen to that you just love rather than you feel like you can actually dissect and learn from. But Joe Frank, I mean, he started doing stuff in the late 70s on KCRW, but predating that, I listen to, you know, I almost feel like the Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, 2,000-year-old man routine. Do you know that one where Carl Reiner plays straight man to Mel Brooks, asking him about, you know, what life was like 2,000 years ago. And Mel Brooks is like this old Jewish man, and he's like, well, we used to pray to a man named Phil, a big man by the name of Phil, and we would pray, and we would say, oh, big Phil, please don't pick us up and squish us in your big, strong arms. And then one day, Phil got hit by lightning, and we realized there was something up there bigger than Phil. And like, I feel like those routines in some way were like the total blueprint for everything that we do on Wiretap with the straight man and kind of set up. What else? There's also Chris Elliott's dad, Bob Elliott, and Bob and Ray. Yeah, that stuff's great. And what else? I just discovered you can listen to it on YouTube. I don't know if any of it's kind of great, really amazingly great. Have any of you guys listened to the radio play that Charlie Kaufman did? Called Hope Leaves a Theater. It's really very inspiring and really complex in that Charlie Kaufman-esque kind of way, but for radio. I know I'm going to think of stuff afterwards.
What about Jack Benny?
I had heard from people that the show reminded them of Jack Benny, and I wasn't familiar with Jack Benny, and I went and listened to stuff and really enjoyed it, but I didn't have a foreknowledge of it. Definitely in a huge way, This American Life. Yeah, I don't know. I'll probably think of other stuff later if you're around.
Can you talk a little bit about the things that you guys do on Wiretap that turns the fiction into reality? So stuff like introducing the idea of a ringtone and then a season later starting to have ringtones at the end of the show.
And we run the show on public Radio International in the States, and so we have to remix them. And I was just re-listening to an episode where we introduced as a joke the ringtone, where I think it was an old intern of mine who had taken me complaining in the studio about how my tea wasn't tepid enough or something and spitting it out into the cup and turning that into a ringtone on her website where she blogged about what a jerk I was. And then about a season later, we actually started using ringtones. And I don't know what the connection is. I guess maybe it's that kind of the show turning in on itself a little bit and becoming increasingly meta, but I had totally forgotten about that. But in terms of just having a ringtone at the end, I mean, it's just a total, like, you know, This American Life back tease kind of thing to keep people listening to the very end.
What about things like the, like having a call-in show, many seasons after starting to do, I'm assuming that the earlier call-in shows were fictional.
I know,
But then to actually have one.
And I'll tell you something about that call-in show, the one that wasn't fictional. Did some of you heard it? Where we actually set up a phone line and people called in with their very real, and you can tell, right, when you listen to them, you kind of feel that they're real. But the thing that wasn't real about it was we actually recorded that in a studio at the CBC, but the sound was so terrible. There was some kind of problem with the mics that we realized that we would have to create a whole soundscape and make it sound as though we recorded the whole thing at this fictitious delicatessen called Chazer's Deli, which Chazer in Yiddish means pig. And so it was like an inside joke, but it ended up becoming a much better show. It became a lot more deep because we were interacting with the supposed people that were there. There's a moment that Howard forgets that he's wearing his wireless mic and walks into the kitchen and starts bad mouthing me with the short order cook and you know, there's little moments like that. But I guess, I don't know. I'm more curious about how it's perceived because I feel like I have a blind spot. I don't know if that's troubling to people. I kind of feel like it's almost like the cartoons, you know what I mean? And like where, you know, the coyote gets run off a cliff, but then he's alive 2 seconds later. Like, I feel like there's a short memory about it that we did those fakier kind of call-in shows, like 5 years ago. And I don't know to what extent people kind of I don't know how people listen to it. I don't know how to answer it, really. I'm curious myself if it's troubling. I mean, what I thought was cool, I don't know how many of you have watched that new Louis C.K. show, but in one episode, his mother is a certain kind of mother. And then in the next episode, she's a totally other kind of mother stereotype. And it doesn't bother me. I don't know how other people feel about it. And that's it, just in a run of like, I think 13 episodes. So.
Anybody else? Last chance.
I have a question. I'm curious to know how you pitched on like this non-traditional form of radio to the CBC. Like, how did it grow and become a show? Were there obstacles there? How did you do it?
It was a very informal pitch, and it didn't strike me as being very high concept, like that people would call in on the telephone. It seemed cheap to produce. Initially, I was just going to do it for the Public Radio Exchange for fun. I was going to just do the show where I talked to my friends on the phone, and I had lunch with the guy who was at the time the programmer at the CBC. I think he just started that job. And I was telling him about the idea that I had, and he was like, oh, you should try to do it for CBC. So I wasn't given a lot of guidelines, and I just thought, okay, I'll do this pilot. It'll be a one-off. It'll be fun, and I'll get some money for it. And it grew. You know, it became, they picked it up as a summer show, and then from there it continued on. I don't know. I guess I was fortunate. It wasn't a very mythic kind of pitching scenario, you know. It was, I think, over poutine or something.
All right, well, I think that wraps it up. Thank you, Jonathan Goldstein.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you. Thank you.